The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all of these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise also has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
The U.S. sat down with the Taliban this weekend.
Both sides are interested in engaging to try to move things forward.
We'll tell you what's on the table. Also today, a look back at the life and legacy of AQ Khan, the man behind Pakistan's nuclear weapons program, the highs and lows.
One thing he enjoyed doing was to establish prizes and then have the prizes awarded to himself.
And the Pandora Papers is putting yet another big-name politician in the spotlight, this time in Brazil. Plus, some serious archaeological excitement is brewing in Southeast Asia.
Right now, we have fossil evidence for at least three distinct groups of humans.
Forget Neanderthals. Homo luzonensis is today's hot ticket. I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Thanks for joining us on what might be a day off for you. It's Indigenous Peoples Day today. In a proclamation last Friday, Joe Biden became the first American president to recognize the holiday. Not all U.S. states are on board. The debate around whether to stop celebrating the second Monday in October as Columbus Day has been going on for years. Not so much in Spain, though, where Columbus set sail from for the Americas more than 500 years ago. There, the holiday continues to be celebrated as a day of Spanish national pride, though some in Spain think it's time for a change. The world's Lucia Benavides has our story.
Every year on October 12th, there's a huge celebration in Madrid. Thousands of people line up along the avenue leading to the royal palace, waving Spanish flags to watch the military parade with cannons, tanks, and planes. And it's led by the Spanish royal family. The holiday marks the supposed day in 1492 when Christopher Columbus arrived on the island of Guanahani in the Bahamas. But here, it's not called Indigenous Peoples Day or even Columbus Day. It's called Fiesta Nacional de España, Spain's National Day. It's the equivalent to Bastille Day in France or 4th of July in the US. It's a day to celebrate Spanish heritage. But October 12th also marks the start of what many scholars consider to be one of the biggest genocides in history.
Se considera que en 1492 se reunificaban todo el territorio, se hacía de España.
Izaskun Álvarez is from the University of Salamanca. She says the October 12th celebrations began in the late 19th century to commemorate what Spain called the expansion of its language and culture to the Americas. She says that these days, most Spaniards aren't consciously celebrating their colonialist past. It's really a day to take off work or school. And for some, that lack of reflection is precisely the problem.
No existe el debate como tal. No existe la prensa. No existe
Álvarez says that in Spain, there's no real debate around this holiday. It's rarely discussed in the news media. And there isn't a big public conversation about the history or the meaning of the holiday. In 2019, Mexico's president asked the Catholic Church and the Spanish government to publicly recognize the grievances committed against indigenous people. But Spain's government refused.
Del Estado, el rey Felipe VI, no tiene que pedir perdón.
Vice President Carmen Calvo declared that Spain does not need to apologize to any country. But Pope Francis did listen to Mexico's plea. Last month, he apologized for the sins committed by the Catholic Church there. In fact, this wasn't the first time Pope Francis said something similar.
Pido humildemente perdón, no solo por las ofensas de la propia Iglesia.
Back in 2015, Pope Francis said he apologizes for the crimes committed against indigenous groups during the so-called conquest of America. The Pope's views are reflected in those of his home country of Argentina. More than 10 years ago, the government there changed the name of Columbus Day to El Día del Respeto a la Diversidad Cultural, the Day of Respect to Diverse Cultures. Many other Latin American countries have done the same. In Argentina's capital of Buenos Aires, the celebrations on October 12th look much different from those in Spain. They're led by indigenous groups playing traditional instruments and waving various tribes' flags. Tony Reyes León is from the indigenous group COM. He says it's important that the government recognize people like him as part of Argentine society. But changing the name of the holiday is not enough.
Nosotros tenemos en la Argentina el 60% de la sangre es aborigen. Entonces, ¿qué pasa? No se quiere reconocer esa parte.
60% of Argentines have indigenous roots, he says, but no one wants to recognize that. He says there's still unequal access to things like clean water and land rights among indigenous communities. Reyes León is part of an activist group called Tres Ombúes. They're fighting for protection of their ancestral lands. He says the least Spain could do is recognize the genocide it committed against indigenous groups, as well as what it stole from their lands.
La mitad de una montaña se lo robaron para España. Todos se han llevado su dinero de esta parte del mundo.
In the Bolivian city of Potosí, he says, half of a mountain's worth of silver was taken. In the end, Reyes León adds, Europe would not be what it is today if it weren't for the wealth it took from the Americas. For the World, Lucia Benavides, Barcelona.
The so-called father of Pakistan's nuclear weapons program has died. Abdul Qadir Khan, or AQ Khan, was a Pakistani nuclear physicist. He built up the country's nuclear program, then was accused and later confessed to selling nuclear secrets. Matthew Bunn is an expert on nuclear security and professor at the Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center. I asked him what exactly we know about Khan's role in the global proliferation of nuclear weapons.
Well, many would say AQ Khan was the greatest nuclear proliferator of all time. First, he stole centrifuge documents and put together a centrifuge supply network for Pakistan's nuclear weapons program. But then he turned it from an import network for Pakistan to an export network and sold the technologies of choice for the determined nuclear cheater to Iran, North Korea, Libya, tried to sell them to Iraq. It was centrifuge designs, centrifuge equipment and technology, bomb designs, instructions on how to actually manufacture the metal components of the bomb, the complete set.
I was going to ask about the profit side of this. I mean, did AQ Khan, was this a money-making thing for him? How did that whole thing work?
Absolutely. And not only for him, but a lot of the people in the network made quite a lot of money. And this network operated for more than 20 years. So it was really a failure of the overall global system that it took so long to take this network down.
How did they take it down?
Ultimately, it was a very impressive joint U.S.-UK intelligence operation. They recruited spies within the network, and they managed to get very detailed information about the participants in the network, about the money exchanged. And then in 2003, they decided to move as a set of centrifuge components were being sent to Libya, and they managed to get the ship seized and seized the centrifuge components. And Pakistan ultimately put AQ Khan under house arrest. Very loose and pleasant house arrest, but house arrest nonetheless.
And do we assume that Pakistan knew about the network all along and they sort of went through the motions of punishing him, but that they were aiding and abetting the whole time?
We don't know everything about what the government knew, but it appears that the transfer to North Korea was probably authorized in exchange for missile technology from North Korea, which was flown to Pakistan on Pakistani Air Force planes. So it's hard to see how the government didn't know about that.
It's interesting. You alluded to the fact that AQ Khan is a hero in Pakistan. Why is that?
Many Pakistanis believe that had Pakistan not gotten nuclear weapons, Pakistan would no longer exist, would have been swallowed up by India. And they see AQ Khan as having played a key role in providing nuclear weapons to save the state of Pakistan.
Can we blame AQ Khan for the ongoing black market proliferation network that's a problem today?
Not really, no. While he was a trailblazer, one major problem is that much of this technology does have civilian uses. And so the people who want it for nuclear weapons purposes develop elaborate sets of front companies and shipments that look like they're going to legitimate civilian places and then reroute it to its real ultimate destination. For example, I live in Massachusetts. We have a company called MKS that makes the world's best pressure transducers, which are a key element of a centrifuge enrichment plant, but also have many civilian uses. And there are hundreds of MKS pressure transducers in the Natanz enrichment facility in Iran. How did that happen? Turns out that Iranian procurement agents managed to corrupt one of the employees of an MKS subsidiary for serving the Chinese market in Shanghai. They faked up documents that seemed to MKS headquarters to indicate that it was going to a legitimate client in China. So known end use for a known client looks good. Let's apply for an export license. They applied. From the U.S. government's point of view, known company that we work with, known end user, known end purpose, looks good, stamped approved, went off, then rerouted off to its real destination.
What do we know about AQ Khan, the man? I mean, what was he like?
Well, for one thing, he was deeply, deeply corrupt. He siphoned off huge amounts of money from the Pakistani nuclear weapons program, from the network that he was running. He would do things like, if they needed a particular piece of equipment or kind of material for the weapons program, buying half again as much and then selling the rest. He would bribe, for example, the people in charge of security for the nuclear facilities he was in charge of so that he was able to take centrifuge components, you know, in and out of the facilities and ship them off to other countries without being called on it.
Good Lord.
He was also a remarkably egotistical man. One thing he enjoyed doing was to establish prizes and then have the prizes awarded to himself.
So I have to ask, did the Pakistani government, did they kind of accommodate him because he's this national hero, but they also were frustrated with him? Or was there a sense that he's our guy, so whatever he does, it's okay?
Absolutely. They're... Various Pakistani presidents and prime ministers were deeply frustrated, but he was untouchable because he was such a national icon. And he had carefully cultivated that icon status over a period of decades. He used some of the money that he got from corrupt purposes for totally worthwhile endeavors, you know, establishing educational institutions, funding kindergartens to sort of build himself up, but also, you know, these were worthwhile charitable endeavors.
How do you think AQ Khan should be remembered?
I think he's one of the worst nuclear proliferators of all time. He was a genius at organizing procurement networks and using them for his own purposes, both for supplying technology for Pakistan's nuclear weapons program and then for exporting to other countries.
Matthew Bunn is an expert on nuclear security and a professor at the Belfer Center at the Harvard Kennedy School. Matthew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here's another glimpse into the world of selling secrets. A naval engineer in Maryland sold a peanut butter sandwich for $10,000 in cryptocurrency. Inside the sandwich was a data card. After more payments, Jonathan Tebbe provided an encryption code to read the data on that card. It contained secrets about the nuclear propulsion system for U.S. naval submarines. Tebbe, who was active in the Navy until 2017, thought he was selling the information to a foreign government. but he was actually talking to the FBI. The nuclear engineer's wife, Diana Tebbe, a high school humanities teacher, allegedly kept lookout when the drops were made. The couple was arrested this weekend and will appear in court tomorrow. Court papers don't identify which foreign country Jonathan Tebbe thought he was speaking with. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Candid and professional. That's how U.S. officials described their weekend talks with Taliban leaders in Qatar's capital, Doha. It was the Taliban's first face-to-face meeting with senior U.S. officials since they took power in August. The two sides discussed terrorism, human rights, and safe passage out of the country for Americans and Afghans. Just by sitting down with the Taliban, the U.S. brings some legitimacy to a government the White House says it doesn't plan to recognize. Kathy Gannon, news director of the Associated Press for Afghanistan and Pakistan, has been following this story closely. She joins us from Islamabad. Kathy, what was top of the agenda when the U.S. and Taliban sat down this weekend?
Probably top of the agenda was counterterrorism. The United States wants to see how the Taliban are fulfilling their commitments to deny terrorist groups a space in Afghanistan. Yes, the Taliban are fighting the Islamic State, but there's also Al-Qaeda, and there are those who still insist that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda have a relationship. There are other groups. There's the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan. The attack in northern Kunduz, horrific. The Islamic State took responsibility, said it was a Uyghur, a Chinese Uyghur, who was the suicide bomber.
You mentioned the Islamic State, and they've taken responsibility for much of the recent violence in Afghanistan, including the suicide bombing that killed dozens of minority Shiite Muslims at a mosque on Friday. Are the Islamic State a serious threat to Taliban control in Afghanistan?
I don't think they're a serious threat to Taliban control in Afghanistan, but I think they're a serious challenge to the Taliban in terms of establishing security, establishing a sense of control over the whole country. They certainly have the strength to terrorize, and that undermines the Taliban's one real sense of what they do well, and that's bringing security to the country. That's always been their sort of pride. Performance is bringing security to the country, and they certainly do challenge that.
What about promises of U.S. aid? Do we know if anything was decided on that in this weekend meeting?
The Taliban said that the United States did agree to provide humanitarian aid to Afghanistan. The U.S. also said that they would provide aid directly to Afghans. The question is, how is that going to be done? Who will it be done through? Will it be done through the United Nations? Will it be done through other humanitarian groups? I did speak to different humanitarian groups, and there is a sense among many of them that the Taliban have been managing to get the aid that is coming in at this point, that has come in on different plane loads, whether from Qatar, the UAE, from Pakistan. They have managed to get it to people in need, but the need is desperate. It's very desperate. And the Americans made it clear when they entered into these talks that it wasn't to be interpreted as a preamble to recognition. But I think both sides are interested in engaging to try to move things forward.
What about the whole issue of women, the status of women and treatment of women? Did the two sides discuss that at all?
The U.S. in its statement said that, in fact, they did discuss it. And one of the things that's very interesting is that it's not uniform what's happening across the country. For example, in northern Mazar-e Sharif, girls have been going to school from grade 7 through to grade 12, finishing high school. It hasn't been happening in every school in Kabul. It's certainly a deep concern everywhere, not just in the West. Qatar has spoken out against it. Others have spoken out against it. So I think there's a lot of pressure on the Taliban that they do make it uniform and across the country, that girls are allowed to go to school, that women are allowed to go to university. They have said that they will, but it will be gender segregated. And now I think the U.S. in its statement said they will be looking for what the actions are going forward, not the words.
Kathy Gannon is the news director of the Associated Press for Afghanistan and Pakistan. She's been speaking to us from Islamabad. Thanks a lot, Kathy.
Always my pleasure.
Tunisia is considered the birthplace of the Arab uprisings. The North African nation overthrew its dictator a decade ago. While other Arab nations struggled to transition to democracy, Tunisia adopted a new constitution, set up elections, and guaranteed freedom of speech. But Tunisia's gains were suddenly dashed this summer when the president, Kais Saied, disbanded parliament. He also said he would choose which parts of the constitution he would follow. Today, he named a new government. From Tunis, reporter Lilia Blaise joins us to walk through the latest developments. Lilia, President Saied seized power in July and parliament remains suspended. But now the president has approved a new cabinet. Can you explain what's going on here?
Yeah, so after the president grabbed power in July, he also enacted a presidential decree in which he holds all the legislative and executive power. He also appointed a new prime minister and gave her the leverage to appoint new ministers and form a government. But on paper, she does not have that many power.
And it's interesting, this new prime minister is a woman, the first woman to lead the government in Tunisia, but of course she's kind of been handicapped from the start. Who is she?
Yeah, so Najla Boulden, she's a geologist, she's an academic, she's very well respected in her field, but it's also controversial because she's the first woman to have the job, but also without any power at all. And it's difficult to know how much leverage the president will give her or independence.
Wow, that's interesting. Lilia, who are the people who have been named to this new government?
So basically, it's a lot of technocrats, people from the university world, a lot of academics, people also close to the president. He's kind of staying true to what he says, appointing people who are not from any political background, who have a sort of clean slate regarding corruption. But it's difficult to know if those people can actually follow through reforms because they are not from the political world, as I said. So people still have mixed feelings about this situation.
So it's interesting that people are sort of impressed with the individuals he's naming because they don't have any taints of corruption, but it's still not clear if he's going to allow them to do anything.
Yeah, we really have to see what's going on next. What is interesting is that a lot of people are hopeful because there was so much political turmoil before. We had more than 10 governments in 10 years. They never had enough time to actually implement reforms. So there is a lot of hope that Kais Saied will be able to sort of change things. But it's still very difficult to know, you know, because there are also so many challenges for the economy that we don't know how much he will be able to deliver.
Yeah, Tunisia's economy is in serious trouble. The new prime minister, Boudin, said she's promised to raise living standards and restore faith in the state. What challenges does this new government face?
I would say the main challenge is that economy is in really bad shape. Part of the problem was, as I said, political instability. There still is a lot of corruption. There is also Tunisia. He's very in debt and has been living on borrowed money from international loaners. The International Monetary Fund says that there is no loan in the works for now. Everything has been on standby since the 25th of July. So Tunisians are mostly waiting for the country to restart again. On the other hand, there is still a lot of hope. And so I think it's also a good sign.
That was reporter Lilia Blaise speaking to us from Tunisia's capital, Tunis. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. Out on the soccer field, everybody is equal, but for some kids in America, getting to the field remains a barrier.
Kids aren't getting the opportunity to play each other.
Why some immigrant children aren't getting the same shots on goal, and protests erupt in Brazil over tax havens and offshore accounts. That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Tens of thousands of people took to the streets in Poland over the weekend to protest a court ruling. Poland's constitutional court declared that parts of European Union law are incompatible with the Polish constitution. The ruling effectively undermines the legal bedrock upon which the entire EU is based. Protesters and opposition politicians are worried this could mean the beginning of the end for Poland's membership in the European Union. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry is on the line with me now. Orla, remind us why the Polish court even made this ruling in the first place. What's this about?
Well, relations between Poland and the European Union, as you know, have been rocky for some time. But specifically, what sparked this case was Poland's reform of its judiciary. So we've already seen the Polish government placing people who are loyal to the government and to the ruling party on a judicial appointments body. And recently, most controversially, they set up a disciplinary chamber that effectively can discipline judges and prosecutors for their rulings. And earlier this year, the EU ruled that some of these actions could violate EU law. And in response, the Prime Minister of Poland, Mateusz Morawiecki, went to the Polish Constitutional Tribunal and asked it to rule on whether the EU could actually interfere in this way and whether EU law had supremacy over Polish law in these circumstances. And the tribunal ruled in its favour. It ruled in favour of the government and of Polish law.
Wow. What's the reaction been across Poland? I mean, how worried are Poles about all this?
Well, as you pointed out, thousands took to the streets of cities across the country yesterday. They estimated there were around 100,000 in Warsaw alone. You saw people holding up placards with slogans like, "I was born in communist Poland, I prefer to die in the EU." The thing is, Carol, Poles really like being part of the EU. You know, well over 80%, according to recent polls, say that they want to remain EU members. And you have to remember that Poland has seen a huge economic transformation since joining the EU. It's one of those countries that's really, really benefited from EU funding. But of course, there are a sizable number who support the government. There was a small counter-protest in Warsaw yesterday where pro-government supporters tried to drown out the speeches of the pro-EU speakers.
Jeez. Now, some have talked about this being an early step toward Polexit, that is, Poland's exit from the EU altogether. How likely is that?
Well, according to the Prime Minister, that's not his intention. What some fear essentially is that Poland might unwittingly set a process in motion that might lead to the country's exit from the EU, a little similar to what happened with Britain and Brexit. And David Cameron, if you remember, when he tried to renegotiate Britain's relationship with the EU, it essentially led to a referendum and to Brexit, which he never intended or ever wanted, and which most of the EU didn't actually think would happen. But there's also worry about what this might mean for the credibility of the EU itself. And I talked to Anna Wojcik about this. She's a researcher at the Polish Academy of Sciences in Warsaw. And she points out that it's actually not just about how it impacts on the EU and its member states.
This would be a huge blow to actually also the countries that are not in the European Union, such as Belarus or Ukraine that are neighboring Poland, because those countries have democratic aspirations and they used to look up to Poland and think that, oh, maybe one day we will also have a democratic transition. And right now we see that the membership in the European Union does not mean that countries will be immune and they can also backslide on democracy.
So what can the EU actually do about this?
Well, yeah, we've had lots of strong words from EU chiefs and MEPs in the last few days, but it doesn't seem like the executive has reached an answer on that. It does have a number of options. It could start what they call an infringement procedure, which basically means it would impose daily fines on Poland until the infringement stop. Another option is it could directly cut the funding that Poland receives, because at the moment, Poland is still waiting to get its money from the EU Coronavirus Recovery Fund, which involves billions in the form of loans and grants. And there are suggestions that the EU could say that the funds are conditional upon respect for key EU values, you know, values such as an independent judiciary.
The World's Orla Barry covers all things Europe. Thanks a lot, Orla.
You're welcome, Carl.
Findings gleaned from the Pandora Papers continue to reverberate. Those were the trove of documents that recently exposed offshore accounts of the rich and powerful worldwide. In Latin America, the documents showed many former and current leaders with deposits in offshore tax havens. The revelations have really rattled the government of Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro, including calls for the resignation of some of his top officials. Reporter Michael Fox has the story.
Last week, about 2,000 housing activists marched in Brazil's capital and occupied the entrance to the country's finance ministry. Videos of the protests show a sea of people wearing red and yellow shirts with the insignias of their housing movements chanting before a row of military police. Their target is Finance Minister Paulo Guedes. The Pandora Papers revealed he and his family were holding nearly $10 million in offshore accounts. The protesters blame him for getting rich off the devaluation of the Brazilian real, even as inflation, gas, and electricity prices soar. Housing policies have also been frozen, a big deal in Brazil. 33 million Brazilians are either homeless or in inadequate housing, according to the UN, and it's gotten worse under the pandemic.
Por isso que nós, né, então fomos ao Ministério da Economia, né, o Paulo Guedes.
That's why we protested at the finance ministry, says Dito Barbosa, a lawyer with Sao Paulo's Union of Housing Movements. Paulo Guedes had millions of dollars in fiscal paradises while he cut resources for housing and social policies in Brazil, he says. Guedes and his family have reportedly made nearly $3 million U.S. dollars in offshore accounts since he became finance minister in 2019. The Brazilian currency has lost nearly 40% of its value against the dollar since then. The Pandora Papers also named two other Bolsonaro allies, including the head of Brazil's central bank, Roberto Campos Neto, and department store mogul Luciano Hang.
Eu não sou e nunca fui contra a vacina.
Hang recently testified before Congress amid allegations that he helped fund a pro-Bolsonaro fake news scheme and pushed the unproven drug hydroxychloroquine for use against COVID-19. The allegations against the country's top finance officials are shaking Bolsonaro's government. Economist Lauro Mattei says Guedes and Campo Neto's offshore accounts are a clear conflict of interest.
Sobretudo por aqueles que estão gerindo as medidas de política econômica para o país, né? E que podem...
He says these are the people who are overseeing the country's financial policies, and they can anticipate profits or make decisions that can benefit themselves. Guedes says his offshore accounts are legal, but many are now calling for his and Campo Neto's resignation. Guedes is a big name in the Bolsonaro government and a bit of an icon for libertarians and conservatives in Brazil. He was one of the so-called Chicago boys and studied free market policies under Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago in the 1970s. He went on to work in Chile under dictator Augusto Pinochet before founding Latin America's largest investment bank. Under Bolsonaro, he's pushed to implement a wave of privatizations that would upend the Brazilian state. Last year, he spoke about his ongoing plans during a meeting with the Brazil-U.S. Business Council.
We have concessions and privatizations in infrastructure, in natural gas, in oil, in electricity, water and sewage. So we are approving of all these regulatory framework to open the frontier for new investments.
But that investment hasn't arrived. And Brazil's economy is not well.
Eles vão gerar mais instabilidade ainda num sistema econômico que já está numa situação muito precária, né?
Economist Laura Mattei says the Pandora Papers revelations will create more instability in an economic system that is already really precarious, he says. Brazil's Senate Commission for Economic Affairs has requested a hearing with both Guedes and Central Bank President Campo Neto. It's unclear whether there's enough political pressure to force them out. Regardless, it's just another political crisis for President Bolsonaro, whose rejection rating is at its highest since the beginning of his presidency, a year out from the 2022 elections. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
Now an update on a story we've been following for many months now, fighting in northern Ethiopia. The Ethiopian government launched a new offensive today against Tigrayan rebels. The fighting has already displaced millions of Ethiopians, and the country is facing a possible famine. Awal Alo joins us now to discuss all of this. He's a senior lecturer in law at Keele University in the UK, where he writes frequently about Ethiopia. Well, Alo, the conflict in the Tigray region has been raging for nearly a year. Can you remind our listeners in brief what the roots of this crisis are? I mean, what this is all about?
Yeah, essentially, it's a difference over the future direction of the Ethiopian state. You have, on the one hand, the central government that wants to centralize power to be in effective control of everything that happens in the country, but also change the political culture in the country, the political structure in the country, from one that is based on the autonomy, regional authority given to various ethnic groups, to a more centralized kind of pan-Ethiopian state.
So we're talking a sort of a power struggle.
Essentially, it's an ideological difference, a political difference that could have been resolved through political dialogues that has really led to a very violent and tragic war.
The Ethiopian government now is trying to push Tigrayans out of the neighboring Amhara region. Orient us, where is Amhara and why is it so important?
The Amhara region is one of the 10 regions that make up the Ethiopian Federation. It's in the northern part of Ethiopia, bordering the Tigray region. So, but also, historically, the Tigrayans and the Amharas, they are the two groups that formed the Ethiopian state historically. So we also have historical antagonism and dispute over power. So part of this conflict is really fueled by the Amhara desire to regain those territories. And when the war began in November last year, Tigrayans forces were forced out of those territories that Amharas used to claim. And Amhara forces and federal forces continued to occupy those territories. And then the Tigrayans, when they started advancing south, they also occupied certain Amhara territories. So mostly the war right now is being fought on the Amhara territories for the last few days.
Now, I wanted to touch on a different issue. The UN is claiming that the Ethiopian government has blocked its ability to deliver food aid to the Tigray region. Could this new offensive worsen the humanitarian situation in that region?
The humanitarian crisis has been getting from, you know, bad to worse. And right now we are looking at some 5 million people needing urgent emergency food and about a million people facing conditions that amount to famine, according to the United Nations. And of course, the reason why this is happening is because humanitarian aid has not been able to get into parts of Tigray where it is needed the most. You know, obviously, if this continues, if no food goes in, the humanitarian situation in the region would continue to get worse.
What are the chances for peace here? I mean, is there anyone that can bring the two sides together? Or are things too far apart right now?
You know, atrocities, according to international organizations, have been committed on all sides. I think that also made the will to compromise and to come to a negotiating table very difficult. The two seems to be very far from one another in terms of their preconditions. They continue to be distant from one another rather than kind of bridging the gap and coming together.
Owel Alo is a senior lecturer in law at Keele University in the UK, and he writes frequently about Ethiopia. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Fall is youth soccer season across the U.S. In many towns, there's the City League, the travel team, and those prestigious but expensive club teams. Access to those squads can be limited, especially for children from other countries who may not have the resources to join. Iowa Public Radio's Cassidy Arena reports on one initiative that's trying to correct that.
Captain, like we talked about last time, is a leadership position.
Tension fills the air as girls in their soccer uniforms wait for the big news at a park in Des Moines. Who will be the team captain?
With the most votes, I have this captain band from back in my day.
Coach Claire DeCio builds suspense as the girls try to tame their jitters. Her eyes shift to one girl wearing a black bonnet and a purple jersey.
So, the U-12 captain is Sarah.
10-year-old Sarah Ngandu probably jumps a foot into the air when DeCio announces that she's the team captain. Ngandu was born in Zambia, and her parents are from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. When they first moved to the U.S., they lived in Las Vegas before Iowa.
Like, in Las Vegas, it's really gray and hot, but there's, like, no jobs that pay really good. And, like, imagine 12 people living in a 3-bedroom apartment.
In Iowa, she's glad to say her parents have better jobs and they have their own house now. Ngandu's story doesn't surprise Sam Gabriel. He runs her soccer club, called Genesis Youth Foundation. Most of the players come to the U.S. as refugees from Africa, or their parents did. Gabriel created the club to try and help level the playing field, both in soccer and in life. Without his club, he doesn't think many of the kids could afford to play. The club covers their costs. He also sees it as a way to try and add more racial and socioeconomic diversity to the sport.
A lot of clubs will have some black kids playing, but it will be very limited because a club cannot take on about 80% of the players being on scholarship, you know.
Jaime Leva shares Gabriel's concern. He leads United Football Academy. Most of the kids in his club are Latino and speak Spanish. And like Gabriel's club, many have a scholarship. He says part of the beauty of soccer is that it can bring kids of all backgrounds together. But here in Iowa, he's noticed a division in access, with some wealthier leagues going their own way by creating tournaments with more expensive participation fees, which leave teams like his and Gabriel's out.
So that is the negative with what's happening. Not only locally, it's happening at the national level, is kids aren't getting the opportunity to play each other.
And Leva has a point, according to John Solomon. He's with the Aspen Institute, and one of its initiatives is Project Play. The focus is on equal access to youth sports. Solomon says soccer has an up or out model that can leave some players behind.
In the sense that, all right, you want to keep playing, you have to play on, you know, this travel team, and you keep having to pay costs. And if you don't play on that travel team, you're essentially out. Like, there aren't many other ways to play soccer in our country, if you think about it.
If kids want to get college scholarships through soccer, their odds are much higher if they play on a competitive travel team, where college scouts tend to gravitate. Solomon's studies find that's why many parents from marginalized communities sign their kids up for soccer, so they can get those college opportunities. Soccer officials say they do notice the access gap. Dan Cataldi is the head of the Iowa Soccer Association.
I think it's important to note that, you know, there's a lot of interest by all involved to make the game as accessible as possible to everyone. Unfortunately, the logistics, the costs are really prohibitive just to run a game.
For example, Cataldi says his association can't just decide how much private clubs should charge or mandate diversity requirements. But he says the kind of clubs that Jaime Leva and Sam Gabriel have created are a strong first step toward greater access. Today, that access is something newly elected team captain Sarah Ngandu appreciates. She loves seeing her fellow teammates celebrate after a big win.
Good job!
She says she wants to be a teacher and a professional soccer player. You know, once she finishes college. For The World, I'm Cassidy Arena, Des Moines, Iowa.
We've all heard about Neanderthals, our shorter, stockier humanoid cousins who died out roughly 40,000 years ago. We know about them because lots of Neanderthal bones have been found in Europe. A chilly climate there helps preserve fossils. There's also plenty of well-financed European institutions to study those bones. But as the world's Patrick Wynn reports, scientists are starting to realize that when it comes to ancient species of humans, Southeast Asia might actually be a much more interesting place.
We live in a fairly boring world, at least when it comes to different species of humans, because we're the only ones around. It's just us, Homo sapiens. It wasn't always like that, though, especially in Southeast Asia. In fact, by the time Homo sapiens bothered to walk from Africa to Southeast Asia, we saw that other human species were already living there.
Right now, we have fossil evidence for at least three distinct groups of humans that inhabited island Southeast Asia for perhaps 1.5 million years.
Joel Teixeira is with Australian National University. He's an expert in ancient DNA, a new field that is tearing the lid off what we thought we knew about ancient humans. Just 2 years ago, researchers in the Philippines found the bones of a previously unknown species of human, Homo luzonensis. They were about 3 to 4 feet tall with really long feet. And only 15 years ago, in Indonesia, we discovered a similar human species called Homo floresiensis, which was also quite small.
They are estimated to have survived until 50,000 years ago. And that's an interesting date because that coincides with the estimated arrival of modern human populations arriving from Africa.
So did we, Homo sapiens, show up and wipe them out because we're so much bigger and smarter than them? Let's come back to that. Researcher Joel Teixeira is focused on yet another species that was hanging out in Southeast Asia before us, the Denisovans. As for what they looked like...
I don't presume to know what Denisovans looked like, and I don't think anyone can.
We don't have that many Denisovan bones. A finger from Russia here, a jawbone from China there. That's about it. We've extracted DNA from those fossils, but Teixeira says DNA can't tell you that much about the Denisovans' appearance. We've actually never found their bones in Southeast Asia, but we know they were there because the evidence is inside us. That's a song from the Aita indigenous group in the Philippines. This summer, scientists learned that many Aita people get 5% of their DNA from Denisovans. Big discovery. Now just think about that, Teixeira says, when we talk about different human species being extinct.
So how do I see Denisovans or Neanderthals or any of these species going extinct? Well, I don't really see them as going extinct. I see them as being more like assimilated or integrated rather than extinct.
Indeed, lots of Europeans and Asians living today have about 2% Neanderthal DNA, myself included. Teixeira says, as Homo sapiens, we tend to think, well, if we came upon another human species, we simply dominated them. But there is no evidence to suggest we were smarter or better than the others, or that we didn't get along as equals.
When you have two different populations having, you know, babies, essentially, I do see them as family units.
Maybe going hunting together, he says, or sharing meals, passing genetic traits back and forth. Now, what about those other two species, the 3 to 4 feet tall ones? Did we have babies with them? We don't know yet. Those bones are so old that scientists are struggling to pull DNA out of them. Teixeira says, just a theory, maybe those species are the Denisovans, hiding in plain sight. Bottom line, he says, never assume any of these species were so unlike us that they lacked art or culture or tools.
To think that they were sort of these very archaic in sort of the worst sort of sense of that term, I think is something that we need to change.
These discoveries in the Asian tropics are very, very new. It is a more difficult place to find fossilized bones because heat and humidity are tough on specimens. But Teixeira, who is Portuguese, says more Western researchers are realizing they need to support their peers in Southeast Asia.
Our job is really to work with them best as we can and try to get that story out there to the world.
Teixeira says this has to be a global effort because the more we learn about our human cousins, the better we'll understand ourselves. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Finally today, we end with new music from a singer who's also a leader for indigenous rights in Latin America, Sara Corichich. She's from the Mayan Kakchikel community in Guatemala and the first indigenous Guatemalan singer-songwriter to sing in Kakchikel for a mass audience. Sara Corichich has taken her message to some of Guatemala's most rural areas and also to the halls of power at the UN. This tune is called Punam. It's a preview from her album Mujer Indígena, or Indigenous Women, which comes out later this month. That's where we'll end the show today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Marco Werman is back in the host chair tomorrow. Chic,
Supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. PRI 2020 donors, including the Rose Family Fund, investing in informed risk-taking. By the Gruber Family Foundation, investing in global reporting and perspectives. And by the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.